had an urge for the latest details of the case. She longed for anything to take her mind off the idea that Thomas could be having an affair. She hadn't seen or heard any updates about Samantha Rogers since she had listened to the radio report the morning at the warehouse. She turned on the television, but with Thomas's late start this morning, all she found was the start of daytime television. The morning newscasts had ended more than an hour ago. She clicked on the radio next and tuned to 7:80 a.m. for the latest news. 10 minutes of stock market talk and commercials passed before she decided to look for the newspaper. The front stoop was empty, and the driveway bare when she looked for the Tribune. She figured Thomas had already fetched it, and she checked the bathroom, a disgusting habit she'd never been able to break him of. When she was unable to locate the paper in the house, she decided to check the trash. She walked to the alley and lifted the lid to the trash can. Inside, on top of black plastic Glad bags, rested an unread Tribune still wrapped in the plastic bag in which it was delivered. Angela rescued it from the trash and hurried inside. The Tribune was filled with stories of the thief and details about the only victim whose body had been found. Angela pulled at her eyelashes as she carefully read the articles, one at a time, and then delicately clipped them from the paper with scissors to add to her growing file. She turned the page and started a new article that covered Samantha Rogers and the shallow grave where her body was found. Angela's skin tingled as she read the story. The body of Samantha Rogers was discovered in a wooded area of Forest Glen, less than a mile from the main road. Deep bruising found on her neck, discovered during autopsy, suggests that she was strangled. The Chicago police are asking for any information about the victim from the night she disappeared, and are leaning hard on Samantha Rogers' parents' suggestion that on the night she went missing, Samantha was wearing a peridot and diamond necklace she had received for her graduation the month before. The police are approaching all city and suburban pawn shops to see if a necklace matching the parents' description will be found, hoping for the first lead in the summer's missing persons cases. The necklace in question carries an engraving of the victim's initials and birth date on the back, SR72957. Any information can be reported to the phone number below. Angela looked up from the paper. Her world narrowed in a migrainous aura of tunnel vision that captured only the utility door to the garage as she gazed through the kitchen window. She was on her feet in a flash, following the periscope of vision and heading out the back door. Chapter 17. Chicago, October 26, 2019. Rory was in full battle gear, glasses, beanie hat, gray jacket, and lace-up combat boots. Her face burned crimson as she sat in her car in the parking lot. She took deep breaths as she thought of sitting across from her father's oldest client, a cold and calculating killer, pretending to hammer out the details of his release. An odd guilt came over her when she considered the notion that her dead father had some nefarious business relationship with this killer from 1979. Nothing can scare you unless you allow it to scare you. She took a few more calming breaths and allowed the attack to escape her lungs with each exhale. When her hands were steady and her lungs freely expanding and contracting without the hiccup rhythm of panic, Rory opened the car door, stood from the passenger seat, and sucked in the cool fall morning. She stood in front of Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois. It was where the thief had been housed for the past 40 years. She had her identification prepared, the paperwork filled out ahead of time, and a copy of Judge Boyles's orders to permit the impromptu visit. Still, processing moved slowly. She was finally called to the window to fill out additional visitation forms. A woman slid the partition window to the side and looked up from her computer. "Name, please." "Rory Moore." "Relationship to the inmate?" "Attorney." The woman typed on her computer for a moment.
Name of the inmate?
Rory looked at the file in her hands, read the name from the bottom flap. Thomas Mitchell. Chicago, August 1979. The utility door to the back of the garage was wide open as Angela pulled the picnic basket off the shelf. The wicker top rolled a few feet away when she dropped it, spinning on its edge like a coin as it twirled several times before coming to a rest. Angela had the necklace in her hand, dropping the case that held it to the ground and was closely examining it. The green peridot and surrounding diamonds were dull this morning in the poorly lit garage, different from the morning when she had first discovered it. Back then, she had sat with the bright morning sun bringing the gemstone to life. So much was different now than had been that morning, like the light of her life had been drained from her, just like from the gemstones. The tremor returned to her hands as she slowly turned the necklace over and strained her eyes to look for an engraving. She held the necklace up to the light that spilled through the window until she could clearly see the engraving on the back. SR 72957. Angela Mitchell's world ended that day in her garage. Some indecipherable correlation formed in her mind between the morning she had attempted to move the couch to the trash and today. Her life had been on a downward trajectory since then, and this morning it had finally crashed in a fiery explosion. She slowly looked back to the shelves in front of her and, without consciously knowing what she was doing, rummaged through other containers. She went through one box after the other until she came to a plastic carton that held Christmas decorations. She slid it from overhead, placed it on the garage floor, and lifted the lid. Inside were strings of Christmas lights tightly wound, sitting on top of an object that she could not immediately identify. Pulling the strings of lights from the box, Angela found a purse underneath. It was nothing she had ever owned. With a feeling of foreboding in the pit of her stomach and with trembling fingers, she unzipped the purse. Makeup and lipstick greeted her, a crumpled pack of Pall Malls and a lighter, a small wallet. She pulled the wallet from the purse as the cigarettes tumbled to the floor. She dropped the purse and turned the wallet over in her hands. She was lightheaded. Her peripheral vision was blotched with dancing stars. She thumbed the driver's license out of the wallet and saw a picture of a blonde-haired woman. Angela recognized her immediately as Clarissa Manning, the first victim who had gone missing in May. Angela had created an extensive biography on her, like she had on all the others. Angela had no way of fully understanding the horrors she had stumbled onto in the storage room at the Kenosha warehouse. But early waves of comprehension began rolling onto the shores of her mind as she thought of the dual nooses and again about the news reports detailing the bruising on Samantha Rogers' neck. She couldn't bring her mind to understand what might have transpired there. As it all came to her, and while she stood with Clarissa Manning's ID card in one hand, Samantha Rogers' necklace in the other, a rattling noise screamed for her attention. Angela's vision was still tunneled as she stared at the relics that belonged to the missing women. She finally had the answer to why she had been on edge all summer. She finally knew the reason why the long-dead obsessions and compulsions from her past had risen from the graves where she had buried them. As much as she tried to convince herself, it had nothing to do with the stranger from the alley or with Bill Blackwell. Her sense of fear had been so acute this summer because she had been so close to the man responsible for taking the women. The clattering noise continued until it finally pulled Angela back to the present. She stared wide-eyed at the back wall of the garage until her mind eventually processed the noise she was hearing. It was the rattle of the garage door opener overhead engaging the chains, the squeak of the springs as they twisted the door upward, and the rumble of Thomas's Ford truck approaching up the alley. He was supposed to be in Indiana. He was supposed to be surveying a future job site. Angela looked down at her feet, the rushing of blood loud in her ears. There, on the garage floor, was the open plastic container, the lid slid to the side. Three strings of Christmas lights were haphazardly stacked next to it, and Clarissa Manning's purse, which had landed upside down, spewed its contents of makeup, lipstick, cigarette lighter, and loose change. The picnic basket and its cover, which had spun to a stop several feet away, lay there too. The rumble of Thomas's truck grew louder as the garage door continued to rise. Chapter 18. Chicago, October 26, 2019. Rory sat in the booth across from Thomas Mitchell. She knew from her father's file that he was 68 years old, but the man across from her looked younger. Deep crevices ran from his nostrils around his lips and died somewhere near his chin. But otherwise, his face was chiseled and young-looking. If Rory didn't know better, she'd guess he was in his early 50s. His expression was stoic when she sat in front of him, his handcuffed wrists resting on the table, his fingers folded as if in prayer, and an aura of patience emanating from him. He lifted the phone and placed it to his ear. Rory did the same. "Mr. Mitchell, my name is Rory Moore."
"They said my attorney was here to see me."
"I'm sorry to inform you that Frank Moore passed away last month. I'm his daughter." Rory noticed something in the man's eyes. Whether it was emotion or simply contemplation was difficult to determine.
"Will this delay my release?"
"No. I've taken over the case and am handling the details."
"Are you a lawyer?"
Rory hesitated, just like when Judge Boyle asked her the same question. "Yes," she finally said. "I worked occasionally with my father, and I've met with the judge who was overseeing your parole." Thomas Mitchell said nothing, so Rory went on. "The judge and my father were negotiating the terms of your parole. I'm familiar with the details." Rory opened the file in front of her. "You have some assets." She pulled a page from the stack. "Just over $800,000 remain in your account. If you're smart with your money, it should last for the rest of your life." He nodded. "My father had financial power of attorney. Those rights have been transferred to me, and the judge has asked that I help you get established financially after your release. The world of banking has changed since you were a free man. The judge has asked that I help you with your finances for the first year and a half after your release."
"What about my living arrangements? I don't want to live in a halfway house," he said. "Frank was working on that for me."
"The judge has granted your request to live in the home located near Starved Rock. I see that you inherited the cabin from an uncle in 1994. My father placed it in a trust for you, and it's been under management ever since as a rental property. The judge has ordered me, along with your social worker, Naomi Brown, and parole officer, Ezra Parker, to inspect the residence before your release."
"Fine," the thief said. "Please make sure the heat is on."
Rory paused at his subtle attempt at humor. "Have you been to this cabin before?"
"When I was a kid. I was surprised my uncle willed it to me, but I'm happy to have it, and Frank has kept it anonymous."
Rory had paged briefly through her father's work related to the inherited property. It made sense now that he had placed it in a trust to keep the owner nameless. "There is a long list of requirements you'll be expected to follow during your first 12 months of release." Rory pulled another page from the folder. "You'll need to meet and speak regularly to your parole officer. You'll also be assigned a social worker who will make sure you are getting settled. There is a list of doctors here that you will be required to see, an internist who will run regular drug testing, and a psychologist you will be required to meet with every other week. All of this is set up to help reintegrate you into society."
"There's not going to be any reintegration. I'll have folks trying to hunt me down. And if any of them find out where I'm living, it'll be the end of me."
"Frank anticipated this and took measures to assure my privacy.
and for the same reason I doubt it would be helpful to make me find work. No organization will want me, and I'll run into the same problem of people finding me. I have plenty of money to live a quiet life, which is what I intend to do. The judge has waived the work requirement based on your age, notoriety, and your financial means. Paperwork that covers all of these stipulations will be delivered to you for your signature. Once the papers are signed, the parole will move forward. Your release is scheduled for November 3rd. Questions?
Yeah. What happened to Frank?
Rory observed the man through the glass. The way he said her father's name felt personal. He had a heart attack.
Damn shame.
Rory squinted her eyes behind her thick glasses. You and my father seem to have had a close relationship.
We did. He was my attorney, and other than the people on the inside, he was the only one I was regularly in contact with.
Rory wanted to ask what her father had done for Thomas Mitchell for 40 years. It was more than appeal and parole hearings. She wanted to ask why this man had paid her father nearly $200,000 in retainer fees. As if the thief had read her mind, he said,
"Listen, I'm sorry to hear about Frank. He was the closest thing I had to a friend. But I've got to concentrate on getting out of here and keeping myself anonymous after I do. Can you help with this?"
His friend. Rory's phone vibrated in her back pocket. Then again and again. 3 notifications in a row. She offered Thomas Mitchell a forced smile, retrieved her phone from her pocket and looked at the screen.
"Rory, very interested in talking with you about Angela Mitchell. I'm in Chicago and would love to meet. Catherine Blackwell."
Rory had nearly forgotten about the message she left in the comments of Catherine Blackwell's Facebook page. She looked back to Thomas Mitchell. There was a woman still looking for justice 40 years after this man had killed his wife. Rory's fingers itched with the urge to type a message back to Catherine Blackwell. "Your parole is still scheduled for next week," Rory said, looking up from her phone. "Nothing's changed." Thomas Mitchell nodded his head, hung up the phone, and pressed the call button underneath it. A moment later, a guard appeared and ushered him away. Chicago, August 1979. Thomas pulled his truck into the alley and pressed the automatic garage door opener. As he approached the back of his home, he saw the top of the trash can strewn into the middle of the alley. He stepped on the brake and shifted the Ford into park, then climbed out and retrieved the top. When he placed the lid back into place, he noticed that the newspaper he had deposited in the trash earlier in the day was gone. He rested a rock on top of the can and looked across the small backyard to the kitchen window, where he'd left Angela less than an hour ago. His senses were on fire since the night of her birthday when he'd found her in the garage. After 20 minutes on the Kennedy Expressway this morning, he felt something was wrong. He decided his trip to Indiana could wait. Things might be falling apart at home, and he had to deal with it. Climbing back into his truck, he pulled into the garage and immediately noticed the boxes and cartons on the shelf were out of place. He knew this part of the garage well. It's where he hid his treasures. Now, as he stared at the shelving, he knew he'd made a mistake by leaving things unattended. Since she'd been through the boxes, who knew what she might have found? He killed the truck's engine, climbed from the cab, and closed the truck's door. Thomas stood in front of the shelf and took inventory. He could tell that she had moved things around, but was unsure what exactly she had gotten into. As he started toward the utility door that led to the backyard, he noticed quarters, dimes, and pennies scattered across the floor. Turning back to the shelf, he reached for the clear plastic box that held 3 strings of Christmas lights and one of the girls' purses. He had placed it there immediately afterward, but hadn't disposed of it yet. It was difficult to get rid of their things. He liked to savor them for a time, until the rush was gone.
He should have kept the items at the warehouse, but there was a perverse pleasure in keeping their personal items so close to his home. Pulling the box from the shelf, he opened the lid and found the three strings of lights wound in tight circles resting on top of the purse, just as he had left them. He leaned his waist against the box and pinned it to the shelf so his hands were free, then moved the lights and picked up the purse. Unzipping it, he poked around at the contents. Cigarettes and a lighter, random makeup. He fingered the wallet and then lifted it out. It was a thin item, with a zipper that led to a small compartment for loose change and slots for credit cards. Thomas looked down at the floor and the strewn quarters and dimes. He turned the skinny wallet over and noticed an empty slot on the front where a driver's license would be slid for easy access. He thumbed through the pockets inside and continued to poke around the purse but was unable to find the girl's ID card. He leaned his body slightly to his right, keeping the box pinned to the shelf, and peered through the curtains of the utility door to survey the back of his home. He could see into the empty kitchen. His forehead wrinkled as he considered the possibility of his wife having discovered his secret. The implications would be disastrous. He dropped the purse back into the box, not bothering to re-zip it. He dropped the wallet haphazardly on top of it, and then tossed the lights in. Sliding the box back onto the shelf, he next reached for the picnic basket and threw the lid to the ground. He ripped the tablecloth out of the basket and found it empty. Dropping the basket onto the ground, Thomas exited the utility door of the garage, walked across the backyard, and turned the knob on the kitchen door. It opened.
"Angela!"
he yelled as he walked inside. No answer.
"Angela?"
He heard a metallic thud in the basement and headed for the stairs. He took them quickly. When he reached the landing at the bottom, he saw a light in the laundry room. The dryer was running, and the lid to the washing machine was open as water filled the bin and Angela tossed clothes in. He startled her when he approached, and she let out a piercing shriek. Her body shook and she crumpled to the floor of the laundry room.
"Sorry," Thomas said. "You didn't answer when I called."
Angela looked up, running a hand through her hair. "The washer and dryer were running. I didn't hear you."
"Sorry to startle you," he said, reaching down and helping her to her feet.
He looked around the room, assessing the situation.
"The back door was unlocked. I thought we talked about keeping the doors secured."
"Oh," Angela said. "I must have forgotten to lock it."
"Did you go out?"
"Yes. This morning, I took a bag of garbage out." Thomas remembered the trash can, the missing newspaper, and the top that had rolled into the middle of the alley. "What are you doing home?" Angela asked. The washing machine made a thundering sound and started gyrating as the barrel engaged and splashed water around. Angela noticed and closed the lid to muffle the sound. The dryer hummed and gave off heat.
"I decided to go tomorrow," Thomas said.
Angela nodded. He sensed her anxiety, a different kind than normal. "Come upstairs," Angela said, picking up the empty laundry basket. "I'll make you some lunch." Thomas watched her hurry across the basement and up the stairs. Alone in the laundry room, he looked around again. He sensed in his gut that something was wrong. He lifted the lid to the washing machine and saw the drum filled with water and the agitator twisting the submerged clothing back and forth into a frothy foam. He stood for another minute and listened to the sounds around him. Finally, his gaze came to rest on the dryer. He listened to it hum and then identified what was wrong. It wasn't a noise that had piqued his suspicion. It was the absence of one. The dryer hummed quietly, but he heard nothing tumbling inside. No clanking of buttons and buckles on the metal interior. No thudding of wet clothes falling from top to bottom as the drum spun. He reached down and opened the dryer door. Dry, hot air mushroomed out of the machine.
When it passed, he looked into the dryer. It was empty. Chicago, August 1979. It was Thursday morning, the day after Thomas had arrived home unexpectedly and surprised her in the garage. 22 hours since she saw Clarissa Manning's face staring back at her from the driver's license she had found hidden in the shelves of the garage. 1 full day since she had identified the mysterious necklace she had found weeks ago as belonging to Samantha Rogers. Were there other pieces of jewelry there, too, belonging to the other women whose biographies she had compiled? Angela had spent most of Wednesday night pretending to sleep, while her mind imagined the women's possessions hiding on the garage shelves. Like a slowly building pressure cooker, her paranoia grew each hour. She was convinced that Thomas knew about her discoveries. She had put the containers back on the garage shelf so haphazardly that he had to suspect she had been snooping through them. Thomas had canceled his trip to Indiana for today and hadn't gone to work. His concern about Angela seeing the doctor had been replaced now by a different preoccupation, the garage. She watched him all morning through the kitchen window, pulling at her lashes and pinching her eyebrows. Thomas would appear every so often in the frame of the utility door when he walked from the back of the garage out to his truck in the alley, arms filled with boxes and cartons. She ran through the moment when the garage door had started opening the morning before. Somehow managing to get things back on the shelf, Angela had rushed into the kitchen and thought briefly of locking herself in the bathroom to claim illness. Surely she had been sick enough over the past couple of weeks for it to be a believable ruse. But she chose the basement and the laundry room instead. With the washer and dryer running, she could pretend not to hear him come home, and then could feign being startled when he finally found her. It had provided her with an extra few minutes to hide Clarissa Manning's driver's license, which she had slipped down the front of her pants. Samantha Rogers' necklace had gone into the washing machine, along with the clothes that had been on the floor. Her skin had bubbled with itch and burn when she left Thomas alone in the laundry room. He had stayed there for a minute or two after Angela retreated upstairs, and she had worried that he would reach into the foaming water and somehow retrieve the necklace. Now, as she sat in the kitchen on Thursday morning, her mind frantically scrolled through her options. She needed to find a way out of the house and away from her husband. She contemplated her options as she sat in the kitchen and watched Thomas empty the garage. She stopped herself from her initial instinct to run through the front door and never stop. But where would she go? To Catherine's? Certainly not. To the police? Possibly, she thought. But then she imagined the disparaging look in their eyes when Angela revealed her fantastic story. They would likely pack her into a squad car and drive her home and back to Thomas. The phone rang. As Thomas loaded his truck with boxes, Angela pulled her gaze from the activities taking place outside. She walked over to the phone and lifted the receiver. Hello?
Mrs. Mitchell, this is Dr. Solomon. I've been trying to reach you.
She paused for a moment, upset with herself for having answered the phone.
Mrs. Mitchell, are you there?
Yes, Angela said in a soft voice. I'm sorry I haven't been able to call back.
Mrs. Mitchell, I need you to stop taking the Valium I prescribed.
The bottle was empty. It wouldn't be a problem.
Mrs. Mitchell?
I'm here.
Stop taking the Valium and come back into the office.
Dr. Solomon continued to talk, his voice static-filled and echoing as he explained to Angela the findings from his exam. Angela let the receiver fall to her shoulder as she released her grip on it. It bounced off her chest and hung from the wall mount, twirling in a circle. She thought she heard Dr. Solomon's voice again, asking if she was still there. Angela sunk to the floor, her back pressed against the wall. If the bottle of Valium was not empty, she'd have swallowed the rest of it. Chicago, August 1979. She lay awake Thursday night, the newly emptied garage running through her mind. All that was left were the only things that mattered. Samantha Rogers' necklace and Clarissa Manning's driver's license, both of which Angela had hidden. Thomas had barely spoken to her since he found her in the laundry room, so she had no idea if he knew she'd found the relics. In addition to the image of the now barren garage shelves constantly blinking in her mind, Dr. Solomon's voice played over and over in her ears, like a record stuck and repeating. She hadn't slept the previous few nights, and finally, with the bed empty next to her while Thomas continued his purging downstairs, fatigue overcame her, and she drifted into a fitful trance. Her sleep-deprived mind took her back to the hidden storage room in the Kenosha warehouse. She walked through the dingy, unlit space, the gray light of early morning barely brightening the windows high in the rafters. When she headed to the back of the warehouse, she twisted the handle on the storage room door, and it creaked open. When the groaning door hinges quieted, Angela heard something else. It was a soft moaning. She stepped into the dark storage room and found Clarissa Manning hanging from one of the twin nooses. "Help me," the missing girl said. She was holding a bundle of something in her arms. Angela walked closer to see what it was. As her eyesight adjusted to the darkened space, she saw an infant child wrapped in the green tarp that had been hanging in front of the door. As she reached for the bundle, the baby began to shriek. Angela bolted upright in bed. She gasped for breath, as if finally surfacing from minutes beneath water. Clarissa Manning's moans and soft pleas for help from her nightmare were replaced now by the growl of Thomas's truck. She threw the covers to the side and raced to the window. She saw Thomas pull his truck down the alley, the bed filled with boxes and cartons from the garage and the basement. Angela quickly dressed. She knew she had only a small window of time. When she raced down the stairs, she saw that Thomas had been through every corner of the house. Angela had forgotten her file folder at Catherine's on Sunday morning, when she raced out of the house after Bill had come home. Now she was happy to have left the research file behind. If she had kept it hidden in the bedroom trunk, where she had always placed it when she was not working on it, Thomas would surely have discovered it. Angela badly wanted to bring that file with her, but knew there was no way to retrieve it. She had no time. Clarissa Manning's driver's license had not been moved since she stuffed it down the front of her pants. She retrieved it now and ran down the basement steps. When she reached the landing, she saw that Thomas had been through every inch of the space. Drawers were opened and contents spewed haphazardly to the sides and onto the ground. Shelves were emptied, and Angela could hardly remember what had once filled them. An eerie chill came over her body as she imagined all the evidence she might have been living with for the past 2 years. She wondered how many more items had been stashed here, and whether she could have done anything to thwart Thomas's reign of terror, which she was sure had been going on for a decade. On the now empty shelves may have been everything she needed to prove her theory. Still, though, she believed she had enough. She ran to the washing machine and lifted the lid. The clothes she had put there the previous morning were flat and damp, the spin cycle having stuck them to the walls of the drum. She ripped one item after the other free until she heard a clanking within the machine. Angela reached in and found Samantha Rogers's necklace. A slight bit of peace found her gut, now that she knew Thomas hadn't discovered it. Back upstairs, she spent 30 desperate minutes jotting notes about her discoveries over the last week. Angela had passed the dark hours of night listening to Thomas rustle through the house, moving from the basement to the backyard, and out to his truck as he emptied the house of evidence. She had listened and prayed. Drifted between panic and fitful sleep, where she had dreamt of Clarissa Manning hanging from a noose. She fought against her urge to run and scream and cry. She had held her breath and formulated a plan. Chapter 19. Chicago, October 27th, 2019. Meeting with new people ranked right up there with root canals. Rory did better when a stranger was otherworldly, a victim who needed Rory to reconstruct their death and discover what had happened to them. She had a harder time with the living. They interacted and questioned and judged. But the meeting with Catherine Blackwell presented an opportunity Rory would find nowhere else. The lure to talk with someone who had known Angela Mitchell was all-consuming. Rory had an unexplainable urge to know everything about her. It was noon when Rory walked up the steps of the bungalow house and rang the bell. Although she had never created a mental image of Catherine Blackwell, other than the grainy Facebook image, Rory was surprised to see a white-haired lady when the door opened. Rory guessed she was 70, perhaps older. The math made sense if she was a friend to Angela Mitchell in 1979.
"Rory?" Catherine asked.
"Yes, Ms. Blackwell?"
"Call me Catherine. Come in."
Rory walked inside and followed the woman into the kitchen.
"Can I take your coat?"
Rory unconsciously had her fist tight on the top button, which was latched and secured at the base of her throat. "No, thank you." Rory managed to remove her beanie hat, but that was as far as she would go.
"Can I get you a coffee?"
"I'm okay." Catherine poured herself a cup, and they both sat at the kitchen table. Stacked on the table were several binders of information.
"I was very excited to receive your message," Catherine said. "I haven't had much traffic on my Facebook page lately."
"I was glad to find you," Rory said, pushing her glasses up her nose.
"I've become a bit of a sleuth in my old age," Catherine said. "And I'm proud to be a friend to the digital age rather than a stranger, as many people my age are. After I saw your comment on my Facebook page, I did some snooping. You have quite a reputation in the world of forensic investigation."
Rory nodded, averted her eyes, and reached again for the collar of her coat, making sure the top button was still secured. It made her feel safe and protected, anonymous somehow, even though she was anything but.
"Yes, I work for the Chicago Police Department as a special counsel of sorts."
"And with the Murder Accountability Project," Catherine said with a smile. "Is that why you contacted me? Are the Chicago police looking into Angela again?"
Rory paused. "Looking into her?"
"No, I'm afraid not. My curiosity about Angela Mitchell is mine alone."
Rory shifted in her chair, leaned a little closer.
"How did you know Angela, if you don't mind me asking?"
Catherine smiled, setting her gaze on the steaming coffee.
"We were dear friends.
I mean, it was so long ago." She looked up.
"Maybe I embellish our friendship when I think of it now. Perhaps I make more of it than it really was. But Angela meant a lot to me. She was a special woman indeed."
"Special in what way?" Rory asked, although she believed she knew the answer.
"Angela was a beloved friend, but also a terribly troubled woman. She had a lot of issues.
Maybe that's why she and I were so close. She didn't have much of a support system. She was estranged from her parents, from what little she told me about them, and she had no other family to lean on. Angela was what we would now label autistic, but back then she was just horribly misunderstood by most. She was also an obsessive-compulsive. She suffered from debilitating bouts of paranoia. But despite it all, somehow she and I settled into a perfectly normal friendship that I cherished. During the summer of 1979, before she disappeared, she was going through another spate of her illness, and I'm afraid..."
Rory waited a moment.
Afraid what?
I'm afraid I treated her no better than any of the people she tried to avoid.
What happened?
Catherine took a sip of coffee to steel herself.
I'm sure you are aware of the missing women from 1979.
Rory nodded. From what Lane had told her, she knew a brief amount about the women who went missing. None had been linked to Thomas Mitchell, despite wide speculation that he was responsible for their deaths.
Angela had become consumed with the missing women that summer. She came up with a theory of who took them and how he had killed them. But they were wild ideas, perhaps considered by some to be a conspiracy theory of a decade-long string of missing women who had all succumbed to the same man. She had researched it all. She had reams of material and graphs and a detailed model of how it had all transpired. Similar women killed in similar ways, all in a tight location in and around the city.
Rory's breath caught in her throat. She thought about her work at the Murder Accountability Project, her and Lane's efforts to find similarities between homicides that might point to trends in serial killings. She thought of the cases that had been solved because of their algorithm. Angela Mitchell had been doing something similar before computers were widely used, before algorithms could be produced, before the internet existed and put information at one's fingertips. The roots of Rory's curiosity about Angela Mitchell grew deeper, stretching into the folds of her mind.
Here, Catherine said. Take a look at her research.
Catherine pushed a 3-ring binder across the table.
This is everything Angela compiled that summer on the missing women, and all her theories on what happened to them.
Rory slowly pulled the binder in front of her and opened the cover. It was strange to see such a large volume of work with so much of it handwritten. There were many pages that looked to have been copied from books, the shadows of the old Xerox machine present on each page. But most of it was written by hand in neat print. Rory remembered the piggish writing from the detective's notes on the Camille Bird case. Angela Mitchell's penmanship was immaculate. Rory turned page after page that described the women who had disappeared in 1979, full biographies that must have taken hours to compile. She read each name, the details of their lives and disappearances sketched in her memory, the way everything she looked at was imaged and categorized. Only the body of one woman featured in the biographies was ever found. Her name was Samantha Rogers, and Angela had gone to long lengths to describe the woman. Rory turned a page and came to a detailed drawing. What's this? Catherine leaned over the table to get a better look.
Oh, she said. That was one of Angela's final theories. She told me she found that contraption at Thomas's warehouse, hidden in a back room. Angela believed it was how he killed the women, hanging them in some fashion. I'm afraid that was all too much for me.
Rory analyzed the bizarre drawing that depicted two nooses juxtaposed to one another, the rope between them winding through a triple pulley system that took on the shape of an M and looked barbaric.
And I'm sad to admit, Catherine continued, that when Angela showed me all of this just before she disappeared, I turned my back on her. I told Angela her theories were over the top, that she couldn't possibly be right. I told her that the summer and the missing women had gotten the best of her and that she was on the wrong track. I tried to convince her that she was in no danger, but then...
Catherine looked away from Rory, down into her coffee again. Her voice was lower when she finally spoke.
Then she was gone.
Rory didn't recognize what was happening at first, and then she noticed that Catherine Blackwell had begun to cry. Rory stirred with anxiety. She was incapable of comforting strangers.
There, there,
Rory heard herself say, wondering where the words came from or what on earth they meant. Rory cleared her throat and continued on. Why do you have all of Angela's notes?
Just before she went missing, she left them at my house. Whether she did it accidentally or on purpose, I've never known for sure.
Why didn't you give them to the police?
Because the police were never going to charge Thomas with anything but Angela's murder. That was clear from the start.
But this drawing?
Rory pointed to the binder.
Didn't the police find this device at Thomas's warehouse?
His warehouse burned to the ground. He made sure there was nothing to find. Rory took one last look at Angela Mitchell's notes before she closed the binder. I'm curious about the Facebook page. You call it Justice for Angela and ask for anyone with information to come forward. What exactly are you looking for all these years later?
Catherine collected herself and looked up at Rory.
Answers, she said, wiping her eyes with a tissue. I've been looking for answers for decades. The Facebook page is just a more public way for me to do it.
But that's what I'm having trouble understanding. What kind of answers? There was a trial and a conviction.
Catherine smiled. It was more a disappointed look than it was a kind gesture. That trial provided no closure. It provided the city of Chicago and all its frightened residents with peace of mind. But it answered no questions about Angela Mitchell. It's been 40 years, and I still want to know what happened to her.
Rory stared at Catherine Blackwell, narrowed her eyes, and cocked her head just a bit.
Her husband killed her.
Oh, Catherine said, shaking her head. I'm afraid that's just not true. See, there's something you need to know about Angela.
Rory waited.
What's that?
She was fiercely intelligent, much too smart for Thomas to have killed her. Angela disappeared on her own accord. I turned my back on her just before she left, and I've never forgiven myself for it. I hope someday to tell her how sorry I am for how I treated her.
Rory leaned closer, resting her elbows on the kitchen table.
You think Angela is still alive?
Catherine nodded. I know she is, and I pray you'll help me find her.
Chicago, August 1979. It was approaching midnight when Thomas Mitchell pulled into the parking lot of his Kenosha warehouse. The long industrial road that led to his secluded lot had always made for perfect cover. During the day, he could see a car approaching as soon as it turned down the smoky road and threw dust into the air. At night, headlights announced another's presence as clearly as a lighthouse spotlight. And if someone attempted a stealth approach, the gravel road would betray the vehicle with loud crunches well ahead of their arrival. Until recently, though, he had never been concerned with such things. He had covered his tracks well, and had a nice distance between the locations of the bodies and his warehouse. But he'd made a grave error by underestimating his wife. Mostly, he overlooked her aptitude for suspicion. Now he needed to take precautions while he considered the best way to deal with her. It was a risk to leave her alone in the house, but he had no choice but to visit the warehouse. The unknown, of course, was how much Angela had found and what exactly she knew. The safest assumption was that she knew everything, even though this was impossible. He thought briefly of the previous night when he emptied the house. He considered taking her here to the warehouse to end things properly, but several obstacles stood in the way of that decision. The greatest of which would be that he'd have to report his wife missing. She would be added to the list of victims claimed by the man the police called the thief, and the pressure on him would be uncomfortable. Part of him was enthralled with pretending to be stricken by the horror gripping the city this summer. But the logistics of that move were complicated, and Thomas had decided instead to take a different route. He had hauled everything he collected from the garage shelves and the basement crawl space, a decade of memorabilia, much of which he didn't remember, into his warehouse and to the storage room in the back.
He had precautions set in place in case things started falling apart or if he ever made a mistake. He never thought the threat would come from inside his own home, and the dilemma had put him in a crunch. His wife was typically a very predictable person. He never had trouble manipulating her emotions or controlling her movements. He was sure with time he could learn everything she had discovered, and mold it in a way that would convince her that she had made a great mistake. But to do that required time, and he wasn't sure how much of that he had. When the bed of his truck was empty, he crawled under each of his cement trucks and punctured the gas tanks. The smell of fuel was pungent when he locked the doors 10 minutes later. As he drove down the dusty road and out of the complex, he saw in the rearview mirror the subtle glow of flames starting to rise from the warehouse. Chicago, August 1979. The package was dropped Saturday morning, along with a large stack of mail on the reception desk at the front of the police station. It sat unattended for 2 hours before the clerk got around to sorting the pile. The package, an oversized, thick padded manila envelope, was finally placed in the detective's bin, where it sat for another hour. Just after lunch, one of the detectives picked up the envelope and inspected it. There was a name and a return address in the upper left corner. Belching from fast food and soda, he brought it to his desk, sat down, and tore open the package. Peering inside first, he eventually dumped the contents onto his desk. Across the desktop blotter spilled a photo ID, a necklace of diamonds and green gemstone, newspaper clippings, and a handwritten letter. The detective slowly inspected the necklace, then stopped when he saw the name on the driver's license. When he finally got around to reading the newspaper article and letter, he quickly picked up his desk phone and dialed. It was Saturday afternoon and the staff was thin.
"Hey, boss," the detective said. "Sorry to bother you on a weekend, but I got something you need to see."
2 hours later, calls had been made, facts had been checked, and at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, the detectives dropped everything back into the envelope, slipped their arms into suit coats, and headed out of the precinct offices. Chicago, August 1979. 2 days after the warehouse burned to the ground, Thomas Mitchell was gravely concerned. He was inundated with police reports, insurance claims, employees and clients inquiring about being paid, and outstanding jobs waiting for completion. He had anticipated all of it and knew there was no other way. But the planned commotion was not what had him out of sorts. He'd come home in the early hours of the morning after torching his warehouse with the stale smell of whiskey on his breath from his stop at the bar, and had passed out on the couch. When he woke late Saturday morning, he had a long list of errands to run. He first noticed the unmarked squad car parked across the street that afternoon. When he made a run to the insurance adjuster's office, he saw the same car in his rearview mirror. He had other places to go, but didn't dare drag the tail anywhere that was unsafe. When he pulled back into his garage hours later, he walked to the front room and peeled the curtains to the side to see the car back in its spot, parked across the street. By evening, he started making calls because it was what a concerned husband was supposed to do. He called Catherine Blackwell and even resorted to calling Angela's parents. No one had heard from her, which he knew would be the response. But what he wanted was a record of his concern, so that if anyone looked, they'd see his desperate attempts to find his wife. It was 9 o'clock at night when he had exhausted his options and considered that the next logical step would be to call the police. He swallowed hard at the thought. He had taken care of the warehouse. The garage and basement were empty. Despite his precautions, he had a strong sense that things were falling apart and that he might have to put his final safety effort into place. Run. He had money stashed for that exact reason. But before he had a chance to seriously consider this last option, There was a knock on the front door. He looked around his empty house, then slowly walked to the foyer and opened the door. Two men in suits stood on his porch. The humid summer night layered their foreheads with perspiration.
Thomas Mitchell?
Yes. The man pulled a badge from his waist and held it in front of Thomas's face.
Chicago Police, we'd like to speak with your wife.
A grave look came over Thomas's face, and he tried hard to morph his distress of self-preservation into something that might be mistaken for spousal concern. He cleared his throat.
I'm afraid I haven't heard from her all day.
Chapter 20. Chicago, October 27th, 2019. They were still seated at Catherine Blackwell's kitchen table. Catherine had poured herself another coffee. Rory had declined again.
You see, outside of a standard Google search, Catherine said, I'm afraid I don't make a very good detective. It's been 40 years, and I know as much about what happened to Angela now as I did back then. The Facebook page was my effort to include others in my search for Angela, which was why I was so excited to hear from you.
I'm not sure I'd be able to help you, Rory said. It was a ridiculous statement, and Rory knew it as soon as the words floated from her lips. Rory Moore was the perfect person to help Catherine find answers. She reconstructed deaths for a living. She pieced together bits of evidence that had been overlooked by everyone else. She poured through information and found answers where everyone else saw only questions. If Angela Mitchell were alive, Rory was better equipped to find her than anyone else.
Then why did you contact me? Catherine asked.
Rory adjusted her glasses.
I heard about the case, she lied. It's been in the news lately, with Thomas Mitchell's upcoming parole. I was curious. That's all. I'm sorry to have raised your hopes, but I'm not the one to help you, and—
Rory stopped herself, then spoke again. Catherine, I don't mean to be dismissive, but have you considered that perhaps the reason you've found no answers for 40 years is because there are no answers to find? Have you considered that Thomas Mitchell actually did kill Angela as he was charged?
Many times, dear. Many, many times over the years. But there's been one thing that's always convinced me otherwise. One thing that's made me sure she's still alive.
What's that?
A couple of years after Angela went missing, a man came poking around. He contacted me to ask questions about Angela. Seemed to know a lot about me and my relationship with Angela.
After the trial? This man came around after the conviction?
Yes, Catherine said.
From the stack of binders, she pulled a leather-bound folder in front of her and turned the pages.
I recorded everything back then. Oh, where is it?
She turned a few more pages.
Yes, here it is. On November 23rd, 1981, I was visited by someone who claimed to be looking into the death of Angela Mitchell.
Rory paused, working it out in her head.
If this man came after the trial was over, what was he looking for?
He never came right out and said it, but I knew what was happening. He believed Angela was alive, and he was looking for her.
A flutter went through Rory's chest.
What did you tell him?
Nothing. I refused to speak with him. I knew what was going on, and I wasn't going to help in any way.
Rory squinted her eyes.
What was going on?
Thomas was looking for Angela. If he could find her, his sentence would be overturned and he'd be a free man, despite the many other women he killed. The women Angela had discovered. The women she became obsessed with. Thomas hired this man to find Angela, I'm sure of it. And ever since that moment, I've known she was alive. She's been hiding for 40 years.
Rory became dizzy. A spinning lightheadedness meant to fog her mind, a defense mechanism, perhaps. but her thoughts were clear, and she knew the answer to her question before she formed it.
"What was his name?" she asked quickly.
"Who?"
The man who came asking questions. Do you know his name?"
"Yes, I recorded everything," Catherine said, looking at the page in front of her.
She ran her finger down the print, stopping near the bottom and pausing a moment before looking back at Rory.
"His name was Frank Moore."
Part 2. The Reconstruction. Chicago, November 1981. Frank Moore was 2 years removed from his stint at the public defender's office in Cook County when he signed on at Garrison Ford. The public defender's gig was a rite of passage for most criminal defense attorneys, a way to rapidly acquire a large number of cases, learn the law, get in front of judges, and endure the spoils of wild courtroom failures. It was a part of every great defender's coming of age, a painful post-law school education.